Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here today. It's a nice Sunday. Apparently, just a little before, we might have some interesting weather tomorrow. So hopefully, check your clocks, check your weather app on a nice Sunday. An interesting topic scheduled for today on euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide with our guest, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall. We'll be with her in just a second. Let her catch her breath running across the parking lot to our building that has its sign out back by the dumpster for deliveries, not always out front for the guests, which makes it a little more challenging for them.
But we made it.
I'm so glad.
Me too.
Apparently, that may have put you in. We're timing you now. So I think you have the record for speed across the lot, time to your chair before we hit the opening.
Well, let's hope we make the record for most interesting. How about that?
Ooh, Dan, mark it up. Let's see what we can do here. Again, our topic today, euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, as our topic, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall. She is the director of the Program in Biomedical Ethics, professor of public health sciences at the School of Medicine at UVA, professor of nursing in the School of Nursing, serves on the Ethics Committee and Ethics Consult Service in the Medical Center, involved in teaching, clinical service, and scholarship. That's an awful lot. It's no wonder you were busy and thinking, all the thinking in the brain on your way to find us today.
Well, you know, it's great because I get to do a little bit of everything. So,
well, and I would think if we're going to be talking about such an important topic, you want to be involved in everything.
That's right. That's right. You know, our ethics consultation service is there for patients and their families and also for clinicians and we get about 5 calls a week, and a lot of them, the majority of them have to do with issues at the end of life. So we deal with that regularly.
Well, that's what I want to talk about today. And I want to talk about, you know, let's just jump right into it. What is your role? I mean, I tossed that big list out of things. And I'm not asking you to talk about each one of those piece by piece, but let's try and stick to the topic that I've given the show from the start. And before we put out the podcast, we may adjust that a little. But if we talk about euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, biomedical ethics is what you teach or involved in.
Right.
What is your role in that? How do you teach that at the university?
So my role is, one, to do clinical consultations at the bedside that have, you know, ethical issues in them. I also teach a wonderful variety of students. So I teach undergraduates who are in the bioethics minor at UVA. Many of them are heading to medical school, nursing school, law school, public health school. And the course that I teach immerses them in one particular unit. Most of the intensive care units, for example, take a student for 6 weeks. So that they're they really get acculturated to the clinical environment, and they see a lot of ethical issues. And so they spend 3 to 4 hours a week in their clinical setting, and we have class once a week where we talk about the issues that they see and the literature that addresses those issues, professional guidance from professional associations like the Society for Critical Care Medicine, for example. And I do a lot of policy work. So, for example, to the issue at hand, the state of Virginia, the legislature has asked the Virginia Joint Commission on Healthcare to study physician-assisted dying or medically assisted dying. So they have convened a work group with stakeholders from around the state to look at the possibility of legislation in Virginia for medically assisted dying. And that'll be a 2-year process. It's in the beginning phases.
Well, that's a question is how, I'm curious, do the students get a full lesson in learning if the state of Virginia already has a policy that says you can't do this? And so the students can see this is what's going on with the patient. These are decisions that the family needs to think about. But the state has already says, you can't consider this because we're not going to allow it.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so my response is that we're studying ethics, right? And so we certainly know and are aware of the health law, the statutes in Virginia or federal laws. We're aware of professional practice norms, like what's the standard of care. But if there is a law that might be troublesome or limiting, then we talk about it, right? And we look at the pros and cons. We look at what other states might be doing in the United States. We will look internationally and see what others do. So the question is not just, is it legal or is it illegal, or is the law silent on it, but what should, right? So ethics is, we call it hortatory, right? We kind of strive for what should be done. What do we think should be done and why?
Hortatory. Explain that to me a little bit more. So, that's not a word that I get to use on a regular basis. Yeah. So I'm curious if you can define that and play that out a little bit
for me. So it means that you're striving to do the best or the right thing. Right? So you're striving towards an ideal, kind of not the... Often the law speaks to a minimum standard that we all agree on as a society, and ethics is looking perhaps at a higher standard of, well, what should we do? Not what are we doing, but what should we be doing? What do we think is the right thing, and why do we think that's the right thing? And we push hard on that with students because all of us have preconceived ideas about what's right and what's wrong. So we really dig into those and kind of challenge assumptions that people might have.
It sounds like a word that we should use in all of our relationships.
There you go. Yeah, we strive for the best in all of our relationships.
I think I'm going to use that. Spell that for me.
Hortatory. 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 Okay. There you go.
I'm going to start using that in all my relationships. Thank you very much. So we're here again with Dr. Mary Faith Marshall, Director Program in Biomedical Ethics, as we talk about euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide and biomedical ethics here during the hour. What is the difference between euthanasia and, as I did my research, I continue to use the phrase physician-assisted suicide, but learned that it's often phrased as physician aid in dying or PAD.
Right.
So what's the difference between the two?
Yeah. So you could think of euthanasia, and that phrase means a good death. That's what euthanasia means, as a broad umbrella. And there are kind of two categories under euthanasia. One would be euthanasia that is directly performed by a physician, right? So that the physician administers a lethal injection, for example. The other form of it, which is assisted dying, is when a physician writes a prescription for a patient, and the patient or the person administers those drugs himself or herself or themselves. So one form of euthanasia is when the clinician is the active agent in giving the drug or the combination of drugs. The other is when the person who is generally terminally ill and dying has those drugs from a prescription from a physician, but that person is the one who administers the drugs himself or herself, not the clinician.
Does the American Medical Association or any other similar organization in the United States have statements on either?
They do. I know that the professional associations, so for example, the American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, do not, their practice statements do not allow for active euthanasia, which is active meaning that the clinician, the physician, nurse practitioner is the one who administers the drugs. However, the American Medical Association and some of the other professional associations do make room for passive euthanasia. Passive euthanasia being when the physician prescribes the drugs, but the patient is the one who administers them to himself or herself.
And passive euthanasia being the PAD, physician aid in dying, the physician assisted suicide, which seems to be the phrase in the general public.
Right. It is the phrase in the general public. I mean, it is suicide. But I think the term of art, you know, has, as you just mentioned, has kind of segued into aid in dying or assisted dying because it generally takes place in the context of someone who is terminally ill or dying already. So it's let us assist you in having a good death.
The phones here, we don't often take phone calls anymore, but it is a topic that may be out there for the public. I will open up the phone lines. Dan, I'm probably catching you off guard with this, and I apologize. But if there are questions or comments on the topic, we'll be glad to take them today. 434-284-9470. Quarter after the hour, again, as we talk with Dr. Mary Faith Marshall about physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, biomedical ethics. So 434-284-9470 here on WPVC. Call us up if you'd like. As we talk about this, one of the things that I found when I was doing my work on this was that, and, you know, statistics and numbers, you never know whoever found them, whoever printed them. But I read that the majority of physicians favor legal access to PAD, again, physician aid in dying. But just over 30% would be willing to directly provide such assistance, even if legally permitted. Do those numbers sound?
Yeah, so how does that work?
Does that number sound accurate?
Yes.
And, you know, can you talk a little bit about that thought process.
Yeah, how does that work? So I think part of what's going on there is respect for other people's ability to make their own choices and their own decisions, or what, you know, ethicists call respect for autonomy or personal autonomy. And so it's the idea that you as a patient, especially if you're terminally ill, should be entitled to a good death. I, as a physician, may not want to be the agent or to participate in that, but I feel that you have the right to make that decision and are entitled to the means to have a good death. I think some of them probably would say that they would defer the practice to physicians who have expertise in that area, right? So physicians who are in palliative medicine or physicians who have a lot of experience with patients at the end of their lives or who are dying. So an obstetrician, for example, probably is not well placed to write prescriptions for patients who would like aid in dying.
So first of all, a couple questions come out of that from me. What is good death?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what is a good death? Let me start by laying a little background and saying that most people, we know from surveys and data, most people would like to die at home, surrounded, you know, in their beds, surrounded by their families, and have a peaceful, you know, as pain-free as possible death. That doesn't happen anymore. We know that prior to the Second World War, most Americans did die at home. And so dying was a lived experience for pretty much everyone in the house, right? So children grew up understanding that death happened, understanding that when you get to a certain point in the dying process where you don't want to eat and drink anymore. And so there, it's part of their lived experience. And we don't have that so much anymore because most people don't die at home, even though we know that they want to. And so they die in hospitals, they die in long-term care facilities, they die in intensive care units, and, they have, some of them, a kind of high-technology death that we know that most of us don't want. Most of us do not want to die in an intensive care unit getting, aggressive treatment at the end of our lives. We'd like to go peacefully. We'd like to go with dignity. Dignity is a huge, probably the biggest driver of requests for assistance in dying, for aid in dying.
Our guest today, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall from the University of Virginia Medical Center. There's lots more to the topic, and there's a few more questions to what we were just discussing. We'll be right back. And here we are again with our guest, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall, discussing physician-assisted suicide, biomedical ethics, and euthanasia. Again, this is a topic that I'm sure some listeners out there have some questions and comments about. You're welcome to call up today. We have the phone lines are open. Given some headphones to Mary Faith, you're welcome to call up. She can listen to your question or comment. 434-284-9470. We're ready for the process if you want to call in. I had made the comment or read something about majority of physicians favor legal access to physician aid in dying, but only 30% would be willing to provide, actually participate. And you said you were talking about how, yes, an obstetrician was your example, might agree that it was having access to that for the patient, but they didn't want to be the person to actually be the doctor involved and explain what good death is, being at home rather than in the hospital, dying with dignity. But you mentioned palliative care. I'm not sure that the general listener knows the definition of palliative care. I don't understand why an obstetrician can't, or my doing my homework for the show is that the PAD, the physician aid in dying, made it sound like all that has to be done is you write a prescription for something that gives the patient a pill to take or something to stab themselves with the medicine when they're ready to go. And why wouldn't the obstetrician say, okay, if that's what you want to do, then here's the prescription.
Yeah. So a couple of things, and I'll ask you, I'll unpack palliative care first, and then we can talk about maybe why an obstetrician wouldn't be the best suited physician to participate in aid in dying. So palliative medicine is, its goals are to prevent and to allay pain and symptom management. So a lot of people think that palliative care is just something that happens at the end of life, and a lot of palliative care does, but it's not just about that, right? So in the hospital, the physicians, nurses will consult palliative medicine if they're having a difficult time controlling a patient's pain or a patient's symptoms. And so they're excellent at that. And I can tell you, University of Virginia has one of the oldest and really one of the best palliative medicine programs, palliative care programs in the country. But they do also are called for patients who are in the dying process because they have a lot of expertise with pain management, symptom management. So nausea and vomiting, for example. And it's kind of a holistic approach. So they have physicians, they have nurse practitioners, they have nurses, they have social workers, and they help not only the patient, but also the patient's family, you know, those who are involved in the dying process. So very holistic approach. They're wonderful. Hospice care does deal with patients who are terminally ill, and for the most part, we would say imminently dying, so that we would expect them to die within 6 months, right? So that's when you might have a hospice at home. You can have home hospice where staff come in. You can have hospice in a long-term care facility, or there are inpatient hospice units. So that's what they are about. Maybe the reason that your obstetrician is not well suited to provide you with the prescriptions and, you know, give you the knowledge about how to go about doing this is that it's not aid in dying, as opposed to active euthanasia, is not as simple as it sounds. So, for example, one of the most common approaches to aid in dying is that a physician writes a prescription, generally for a drug called secobarbital or pentobarbital. And you take, for the secobarbital, that's about 100 pills that you have to take. So it's not just one pill and boom, you're gone, right? So you may have to take up to 100 pills, or somebody may have to take those capsules if you can't swallow pills, or 100 pills. And put them in a drink for you. Take the capsules apart and pour them into a drink. It tastes bitter. It tastes nasty. It can make you nauseous. So sometimes, or nauseated. So often physicians will also prescribe an antiemetic drug, and you don't know how long it's going to take, right? So it could take from minutes to, you know, up to 100 hours. So there's a certain amount of expertise in terms of knowing your patient, knowing your patient's underlying medical condition, and thinking about what the best approach is. So really, general medicine physicians and physicians who have expertise in treating people who are terminally ill are probably better prepared because that's what they practice. Just as, you know, a palliative medicine physician is not going to practice obstetrics, right, then an obstetrician wouldn't be practicing general medicine of that sort.
Now, euthanasia is illegal throughout the U.S.
It is. Active euthanasia, or, you know, the physician being the agent, or anyone being the agent, you know, the one who pushes that drug in.
Right. But the PAD, the physician-assisted suicide, physician aid in dying, is legal in a handful of states.
Right. It's legal in six states and in Washington, D.C. So it's legal. It started in 1997 in Oregon. And so we've got 21 years of experience. The nice thing about Oregon is that part of their legislation requires accumulating data. So not just does a formal written report have to be turned in by the physician, but also they very wisely have data on every person who has used physician-assisted dying and the circumstances there. So they've got a lot of knowledge. So, for example, once physician aid in dying became possible in Oregon, they have seen a trend, a significant increase in the number of patients who are now using hospice. And a lot of the patients who avail themselves of aid in dying are also hospice patients. And that's comforting to know that there's, you know, again, kind of a holistic approach to it. The other states are California, Washington, Colorado, California, Vermont, Wisconsin, Montana, and then Washington, D.C. So we have six states and others that are looking at it.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall, involved with biomedical ethics at the School of Nursing and School of Medicine at the University of Virginia. So tell me how this part, how the physician aid in suicide, the physician aid in dying, plays in what you're teaching in biomedical ethics at the university. Is this a day of classroom teaching? Is this a week? Does this play throughout the semester?
I would say it plays throughout the semester, although we certainly target particular classes looking at death and dying. So not just assistance in dying, but what it means in the hospital or the intensive care unit to withhold or to withdraw life-sustaining treatment. So there's a large sort of umbrella of issues that attend to death and dying, including, for example, clinicians, physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, social workers who are involved, maybe involved in conflict at the end of life. Conflict at the end of life. So conflict at the end of life or disagreements, and they could happen between family members or surrogate decision makers. If you have a patient who's not a capable decision maker, they can happen between the patient and the patient's surrogate decision makers, or they could be disagreements between the patient's surrogate and the healthcare team. And those are probably, I would say, 70% of the consults that we get on our ethics consult service have to do with disagreements and working those disagreements out at the end of life. And that's been true at every medical center that I've worked at, every academic health center. And I think most clinical ethicists around the country would tell you the same thing.
So as I'm, you know, preparing for you today, the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. Which falls into less harm? the doctor knowing that little can be done but wait and possibly medicate and watch the body cause itself pain, or less harm is for the doctor to provide physician aid in dying and end the person's suffering.
Right. Well, you hit the nail on the head. So the Hippocratic Oath, the Hippocratic tradition has, you know, evolved over time. So, for example, the original Hippocratic Oath required that no knowledge that the physicians had could be given to anyone else, right? And women didn't practice medicine, right? So there are a lot of constraints that were there in the early Hippocratic tradition that have changed over time, just as medicine has changed over time and, you know, society has changed over time. But I think the first do no harm tenet of the Hippocratic Oath is perhaps one of the things that drives aid in dying. And as you said, the question is, is it more harmful to a patient in terms of his or her or their lived experience to be in pain or to lose dignity? And then to have a good death and to be with that patient. You know, one of the things that we hope never to do is to abandon our patients. And so you want your physician ideally to be there with you for the entire journey. You know, that's comforting to know that person is there.
But aren't there, especially in today's world, as medicine has grown, and not just grown in terms of more learned and increased in knowledge, but it's also grown sort of, and I'm sitting here making these hand gestures that are listeners can see, but it's grown upwards as it's gotten more knowledgeable, but it's grown to the sides as it's more people have gotten Eastern, Western. So a patient who is ill comes to the doctor and says, so what comes first, the patient's choice of treatment or the doctor's choice of treatment? I don't want chemotherapy, but that's what the doctor suggests and practices. And if he won't do what I want, he tells me to go get a second opinion, which can take 2 or 4 or 6 weeks of time. And during that time period, my body is continuing to break down.
So you're talking about really the kind of the fundamental one, rights that we have as patients, and also standards of practice that clinicians have, not just physicians, but others. And so basically, patients are entitled to consent to or to refuse recommended medical treatment. And there's a lot packed in there, right? So a capable adult decision maker or a surrogate decision maker for someone who's not capable has the right to refuse treatment, can refuse life-sustaining treatment. The Nancy Beth Cruzan case that went to the United States Supreme Court in the late 90s established that. You have the right to say no. So, for example, if I'm a Jehovah's Witness and I do not want blood products, I have the right to say no, and I can, you know, die of something that would be easily fixed if I were to receive blood products. So we are not entitled as clinicians to force patients to have things that we would like for them to have. So the other side of that coin is that, you know, the hospital isn't the candy store, right? And people aren't entitled to come in and say, oh, I'll have one of those and one of those and one of those. So again, the dynamic is patients can consent to or refuse treatment that's recommended, but they can't demand treatment that's not the standard of care. And really the ideal is shared decision-making, right? That you're having a conversation with your clinician, right, and that patients' values are explored. You know, the clinicians explain what's possible, right, what the options are, and ideally try and hone in on what that best option is. But there's not always an agreement, right?
Again, our guest today, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall, as we talk about biomedical ethics and physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. Is religion the reason that pets can have euthanasia, but not people?
Oh, great question. Are you saying that religion prevents people from having, that religious beliefs may prevent people from
having? That we have laws for that. I mean, right. I can take my dog because my dog is suffering.
Right.
And I believe that my dog is at the end of life, right?
Yes.
And for dignity for my dog.
Right, yeah.
You know, I'm not the person who's going to take my dog there because of expense. It's too expensive to keep bringing my dog here. I'm of the type that my dog is in pain, and for dignity of my dog, I can see how he has changed. And it is at the end of his life, and instead of watching him injured and hurt, etc., it's time for the physician to bring about his death through pharmaceuticals. And so that is euthanasia, correct?
Yes, that is euthanasia.
And we don't allow that for people in the same circumstance. Is that not allowed for humans? And is the reason for that religion?
It's one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons. So there's a long history of proscriptions against suicide. And some of them are religious, and different religious traditions, that life is precious. It was given to you by God, and that God will take it away, right? Not you. God will determine when the time is for your death. Other reasons were more pragmatic. So, for example, in Great Britain, for many years, it was a crime to commit suicide, and if you did, then all of your belongings remitted to the king, right? And you were buried in the crossroads. And the idea there was that, you know, the king did not want to lose your property, right? So you might take your life, which was against the law. And if you did, then the king got all of your worldly goods. So it was kind of a way of saying, I wouldn't commit suicide if I were you, because everything then devolves to the king, not to your family. And it's a disgrace. And you won't be buried in the churchyard. So a lot of it did have to do with religious beliefs.
40 minutes after the hour, an amazingly interesting conversation that I'm just poking back and forth and all over the place with, and Dr. Mary Faith Marshall is somehow keeping up with my loose brain today. Hang tight. All right, and we're back. Thank you for listening to this topic today. Dr. Mary Faith Marshall wishes with us. She's the director of the program in biomedical ethics. Dr. Marshall, why do people ask for this? I mean, I had always assumed it was because they don't want to deal with this anymore. Life is over. It's too painful. Please let me go.
Well, I think you are, to a certain extent, right on target, right? And so people ask for assistance in dying, not because they want to die, right? It's because the suffering that they're undergoing, whether it's generally it's physical suffering, could be psychological suffering, could be loss of dignity, is that I can't live, I can't suffer this way anymore. And so if there were a way to fix that suffering, they wouldn't want to die, right? But they basically feel that they're out of options and I just can't do this anymore. I think one of the myths about assisted dying is, and it makes sense, is that people ask for it because they're in pain. We know that, at least in the United States, 70% of the patients who ask for assisted dying in the states that allow it, that offer it, have cancer. But pain is not the driver. The driver, actually, the drivers are, and we know this, again, because Oregon and Washington now have decades worth of data, is that they want control over their dying process. They want control. They don't want to be dependent on others for all of their bodily functions. They don't want to burden their families, either with caregiving or sometimes financial responsibilities. And they don't want to lose dignity. So dignity is actually, dignity and control are generally the drivers, not pain.
What about the negative outlook? I mean, there's pain, but do we know, are we talking about the pain from cancer? Are we talking about the negative outlook from cancer? Oh, I only have 6 months to go. Are we, and please, if I'm asking listeners or Dr. Marshall, if I'm asking these questions and they come across poorly, please forgive me. If someone has cancer and you take care of your checklist of things that you want to do for your family, for yourself, for your friends, and you do that and you believe that your physician's, you know, what your physician has said as to your length of time to go, then you're ready. If you have been scripted with Alzheimer's and you don't want to put up with that and you go through life until you feel that the seesaw has, you know, has switched.
Right. Right.
Do we have any knowledge on the negative outlook versus just pain?
Right. So I think, you know, people have a sense of this is who I am and this is who I want to be and this is who I want to be during the dying process. And so I think it's less about pain because we can, for the most part, treat pain. Palliative medicine has made huge strides in the last 30 years. We need better drugs to treat pain, but some people don't want to lose the kind of their intellectual sharpness when they reach the end and they feel that they're being, you know, that the narcotics especially or other drugs that they're taking make them less aware of what's going on, less able to interact with other people and enjoy their environment. So I think it's really a quality of life argument. And the other thing that we know, this is interesting, is that once people who are dying, who are terminally ill and dying, are reassured, know that they have the option, they may discuss this with their physician, right? When I get to this point, then it's not, you know, the candle's not worth a flame anymore. But when they know, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about control, right? They are reassured that they will have control over the dying process. Many of them elect not to use it, or they will use it later. So that anxiety about me being dependent, me being a burden, me losing dignity, kind of is allayed by the notion or the idea that, you know, when the time comes, I can say, this is it.
Do we have any sort of statistical numbers of this pain and negative outlook versus the vegetative state? I did a show, I don't even know how many years ago. You may remember the dates. Is the proper pronunciation, is it Terry Schiavo?
Mm-hmm. Terry Schiavo, yes.
And that, I believe she was in a vegetative state, and there was the the argument between, was it the husband and and her parents?
Yes.
About whether she should have the
her artificial feeding and hydration
removed,
withdrawn.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And see what happened then. And so do we know do we have any percentages to what's done with the vegetative state?
Yeah. I don't know those data off the top of my head. I know that all of the states have laws that allow for us to have an advance directive. As I said earlier, you have the right, and this came up in the Nancy Beth Cruzan case in the late 90s, very similar case to Schiavo. So the three biggest cases in what we call right to die cases in the United States, Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Beth Cruzan, and Terry Schiavo, all of them were young women in their early 20s, right? And so most people in their early 20s are not thinking about their own mortality. They're not staring it in the face, and they don't make plans. They don't have advance directives. But Cruzan, which, as I said, went all the way to the Supreme Court. She lived in the state of Missouri, and she had been in a vegetative state for a while, and her parents wanted to withdraw her artificial feeding and hydration. And the Supreme Court says, you know, they upheld that. They said the idea that every patient has the right to refuse treatment, even life-sustaining treatment. And if you're not able to do it, and your surrogate decision makers know that you would not want to live this way, then they have the right to refuse it for you because they're acting as your voice or, you know, your agent. That's their job. What would he have wanted? What would she have wanted? And Michael Schiavo and Nancy Cruzan's parents all felt, you know, that we've given this, you know, 5 years, 7 years, we've given this long enough to know that our daughter or my wife's situation is not going to turn around. And I know that she would not want this existence. So that even though we can keep people who are in a state of permanent unconsciousness alive with good nursing care for decades, the idea is that most of us wouldn't want to exist that way, and we do know those data. And so that's why advance directives, the directive part of it, allows for you to say, I don't want aggressive treatment, A, if I'm terminally ill and dying, or B, if I'm in a state of permanent unconsciousness. Right? So they allow for that, knowing that most of us, some do, right? But some do find meaning in that. But most of us would not want to live in a state of permanent unconscious or to exist in that state.
Sunday morning wake-up call here, 94.7 WPVC. We are talking about biomedical ethics and euthanasia and physician aid in dying with our guest, Dr. Mary Faith Marshall. Dr. Marshall, globally, Netherlands and Belgium have approved this practice. Are there other foreign countries? Are there anything special that goes on in these two countries?
So the Netherlands was the first, and other countries have followed. So the Netherlands, Belgium, Colombia, Luxembourg, Canada now, and India allow for euthanasia. Switzerland, Germany, and Japan allow for physician-assisted dying. A couple of interesting things. One about the Netherlands is that, so the age range in the Netherlands is for euthanasia, which has to happen on request, right, by the person, has to request it, is that the age range begins at 14, but children who are between 14 and 16 in the Netherlands have to have their parents' consent. The Netherlands also allows for euthanasia of newborns and of infants who are born with genetic conditions or with diseases from which, you know, they, for which there is no cure and which entail a huge amount of pain and suffering. So even though a newborn, you know, can't ask for euthanasia, the parents can request it. It also requires the approval of the parents, of physicians, and of a social worker. And all of that is carefully monitored and documented as well. So the Netherlands allows for a broader scope of euthanasia than other countries do. Belgium allows for not just physical illnesses like people with cancer. They allow, for example, euthanasia for people who have treatment refractory depression. I've had depression for years or decades. I've tried, you know, I've made a good faith effort. I've tried all the pharmacotherapy. I've been in treatment. And there is such a thing, you know, unfortunately, as treatment resistant depression. And so there aren't many, but they do allow for it.
11:54. So we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to get at least these last two questions in. For the elderly, I would think that there are certainly a percentage that can't answer these questions themselves if they wanted physician aid in dying, or in some of these global countries, euthanasia. They would have to have someone speak for them. Is there a concern about the ethical question?
Yeah, that raises what we call the slippery slope question, right? That if we think about euthanasia or assisted dying in the context of, I'm a capable decision maker, I'm asking you for it, you're getting a second opinion, there may be a, you know, a psychological evaluation if there needs to be, but there are all these safeguards there, right? And the concern is that we might go down the slippery slope to people who can't ask for it or can't say, I don't want it, right? And there may be hidden agendas like, you know, secondary gain like money or the estate or other things. And so that is a big concern. I think there are other ways of dealing with someone, let's say, who has Alzheimer's, or, you know, someone who can't.
Or if they can ask for it themselves, but they're being pressured to do so.
That's right.
Or led to,
right,
or lied to, or just.
Yeah, they're being coerced.
Yes.
Right. So a lot, if you look at the states in the United States that have, that allow for assisted dying, they've been very thoughtful in their procedural safeguards. And so they, you know, make sure that there isn't coercion, right? I want to talk to you as an individual alone. I don't want your wife in the room. I don't want your family in the room. I want to make sure that this is what you want and the reasons for it.
And just part B of this first question is the mental illness part. Is there a way to account for that by the United States or the states that allow for this, or the countries? Global countries.
Yeah, right now, in the United States, physical terminal illness, right? So not psychiatric illness. Only terminal illness, imminent death, are the criteria. I think Belgium's the only country that allows for psychiatric illness, although certainly, you know, that's can be a serious form of suffering.
Okay, so the second question I want to make sure we get in here is, what effects does this have on the insurance companies? Are the insurance companies okay with this? Are they paying for this? Would they want this or not? You know, how does this play into the insurance card?
Great question. I'm so glad you asked it. So in, you know, some insurance companies do reimburse for assisted dying. Not all, but some do. And I think
it saves them money in the end.
Right. And I think, you know, as more and more states opt, and I think they will opt for assisted dying, then more and more companies, you know, for the reason that you said, will allow for it. One thing I want to say is that after California legalized assisted dying, Valiant Pharmaceuticals, which is a Canadian company, raise the price for Seconal, which is one of the drugs that's used, one of the pills that's used, so you need 100 pills of 100 milligrams Seconal, right, to get 10 grams of Seconal, which is the amount that you need. So they raised it from what used to be $150 for about that to $3,000.
Didn't they just put some guy in jail for doing that for some other pill?
Yeah, so you know, shame on them. There are others now who are looking at other combinations of drugs because they're not prohibitively expensive. But isn't that sad?
All right, 1 minute left. What would you like to share with us that we have not talked about?
I guess I would like to say that I know that a lot of people are worried or afraid, especially about the slippery slope relative to assisted dying, and that I hope that they're comforted by the fact that we have, even in the United States, decades worth of experience and decades worth of data, and that we've not seen people go down the slippery slope that we're legitimately worried about, right? That we have good documentation and that it's used for people, you know, who are dying and are able to say, I don't want
this. If I wanted to do this, do I need to move to Oregon and live there for a year?
All of the states in which it's legal require citizenship in that state. So the answer is yes.
All right. Dr. Mary Faith Marshall from University of Virginia Medical Center, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you'll return sometime in the future.
I will, and I'll try and be here 2 minutes before.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Bye-bye, everyone. Wahoo wah.
Yeah.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.